He led me at a great pace along the hallway, through a heavy door and out into a different world. A great marble staircase curved up ahead of us with a red carpet going up its center. Up we went, so fast that I had to pick up my skirts and was out of breath by the time we reached the top. Then he hurried me along a broad gallery where portraits of former monarchs frowned down at me, and there were statues in niches. There was a thick Axminster carpet underfoot, and the walls were covered with rich brocade. I hardly had a moment to take this in, as the footman came to a halt before double doors, then opened one cautiously. "The pastry chef that you requested, Your Majesty." With that, I was almost pushed inside. I stepped into a large sitting room. It was a pleasant sort of room, not too grand, with tall windows that opened onto the grounds at the side of the palace. Velvet sofas and armchairs were arranged around a marble fireplace in which a healthy fire was glowing. In one of the high-backed chairs, a little old woman was sitting. I had seen pictures of her aplenty, of course, but she seemed even smaller in person, her feet resting on a footstool. In truth, up close for the first time, she looked like anyone's grandmother, a white shawl around her shoulders and a lace cap upon her head. She looked up in surprise as I entered.
"You're a girl," she said.
"Yes, Your Majesty." I attempted a curtsy.
"I thought all my cooks were men," she replied. "Where is my pastry chef?"
"I am only an undercook, Your Majesty," I replied. "But Mr. Rowland, who normally makes your pastries, met with an accident this afternoon, and I had to step in and take his place. I am sorry if my efforts did not measure up to your usual standards."
"An accident? I trust it was not too severe."
"He cut his finger, Your Majesty, but he felt that the cut required stitches, so he was taken to a local hospital. However, I expect he will be perfectly fine by tomorrow and able to resume his activities." She was looking at me critically.
"You're nicely spoken for a servant girl. What's your name?"
Oh dear, I was about to lie to a queen. Images of the tower and dungeons swam into my head. "It's Helen, ma'am. Helen Barton."
"Well, Helen, I've summoned you today because we found the scones to be particularly delicious. We both commented on them."
That was when I noticed that she was not alone. A portly man with a neatly trimmed grey beard was sitting in a high-backed chair across the fire from her. I'd seen images of him in newspapers. The Prince of Wales. He was looking at me appraisingly.
"Mama, you did not tell me that you were employing young women in the kitchen these days," he said.
"I thought it was about time that the palace was forward-looking," the Queen replied. "The new century is coming. Young women should have a chance to make something of themselves. Heaven knows that most of the cooks in the great houses around the country are women. It's a natural art for us females."
She stirred herself in her chair and looked around the room.
"Frankly, I've been thinking for some time that the kitchen is in need of new blood. My dear Moonshee complained to me that apparently my cooks cannot produce even the simplest of Indian dishes for him. He was entertaining a fellow countryman, and the chicken curry was quite unpalatable. He is a Muslim, poor Abdul, and has quite strict dietary requirements."
"I don't know why your kitchen staff has to go to any great lengths for a fellow servant," the prince said shortly.
"A fellow servant?" The queen frowned.
"He is my one companion and solace, as you very well know. I value his advice, even if he can be rather bossy on occasion. But I like that. It reminds me of when my dear Albert was alive, and he clearly worships me."
She gave a heavy sigh.
"Life would be quite meaningless if Abdul was not here."
"The chap is a bounder of the worst kind, but you are too blind to see that because he fawns and flatters."
The queen now sat very upright and gave him the haughtiest of stares.
"As monarch of this country, I think I have the right to choose my own courtiers and my own friends," she said. "You will do well to remember that, Bertie."
If and when you become king, you will be able to do the same. And I expect there will be many in the country who will criticize your choice of companions."
She reached over to the serving tray, took the last piece of shortbread and popped it into her mouth. Then she seemed to remember that I was standing just inside the door.
"We shall not discuss such matters any further," she said. "I am the one who makes the rules in my own household. I have decreed that I want to introduce young women into my kitchen to bring new life and vigour. And you see, I was right in my prediction. This young lady steps in and bakes us the most delicious scones. We finished the plate between us, and I dare say we could have attacked a second plate had one been offered."
"I can go down to the kitchen and make you a second batch if you wish, Mum," I said, but she held up her hand and smiled.
"One does not want to spoil one's appetite for dinner," she said. "As my dear Baroness Lazen used to say, enough is as good as a feast."
She waved a hand in my direction.
"Run along now. I expect you are needed for the dinner preparations. But I shall look forward to scones made by you every afternoon from now on. You are to tell Mr. Angelo that I have made this request of you."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
I curtsied again and attempted to back out of the room, praying that I wouldn't bump into any precious object on the way. I reached the door successfully and stood for a moment in the hallway outside, trying to calm myself. It was indeed a heady moment, and I wished that I had someone to share it with. Instead, I was dreading informing Mr. Angelo, and more especially Mr. Rowland, of Her Majesty's instructions. They might not take kindly to an upstart girl pushing herself forward like this. I looked around for the footman who had escorted me, but not seeing him, I started to make my way back along the hall. I was halfway down the grand staircase when I heard footsteps behind me. I paused and glanced around to see the Prince of Wales following me. I flattened myself against the wall, allowing him to pass, but instead he drew level with me.
"What's your hurry, Bright Eyes?" he asked.
He was looking at me with a sort of half-smile.
"I have to get back to my duties, Your Royal Highness," I replied, my voice scarcely more than a whisper. "I have to make the puddings for dinner."
"Nonsense," he chuckled, a deep throaty chuckle. "Nobody can complain if the Queen kept you, can they? Or even if the Prince of Wales kept you."
He took a step closer to me, rather too close to be comfortable.
"What a delightful little creature you are."
He raised a hand and stroked my cheek.
"Do I detect a wisp of auburn hair under that severe white cap?"
And before I could do anything, he had whipped the cap from my head. To my mortification, my hair tumbled over my shoulders. The prince's eyes lit up.
"I was right."
He picked up a curl and toyed with it.
"I have a distinct softness for red hair. Redheads are supposed to be fiery and passionate, aren't they? Are you fiery and passionate?"
"No, sir," I mumbled. "I'm sure I'm a most quiet and well-behaved young woman."
He laughed, tugging on my hair. "That's because you haven't met the right man to wake you up yet. I bet you'll be a little tiger one day."
I could feel my cheeks burning, trying to think how I could possibly get away. But he had me pinned against the wall, and one can hardly give the heir to the throne a good shove.
"Please, sir, let me go,"
I whispered.
"I really should get back to the kitchen."
"I'll wager you have more talents than making scones," he said. His eyes were challenging me.
I could sense what he was hinting at, but I replied,
"Perhaps I do, Your Highness. I am told I have a light hand with pastry."
This made him throw back his head and laugh heartily.
"What a sweet innocent you are. I can't wait to taste your pastry, young woman, or experience your light hands. Why don't you come and cook for me? I'm sure we can find you a position in my household, more money too, and other privileges. I'd enjoy getting to know you better."
My cheeks were burning, and my mouth was so dry I could hardly force out the words.
"I couldn't do that, Your Highness. I am only newly hired by the Queen.
It would be rude and disloyal to leave now, when she has given me such a wonderful chance.
Enchanting and honourable, too, he said, letting the strand of hair fall to my shoulder, tracing the line of my neck with his finger, down to where the top of my dress prevented further exploration.
But think it over, my sweet. You would not find your duties onerous in my employ, I promise you. And I travel abroad. The Riviera in the spring is most delightful.
He gave me a playful little smile.
I'm sure it would be an honour to work in your household, sir, I replied. But I owe a great debt of gratitude to Her Majesty.
I suppose I will accept rejection for now, he said. I will go home dejected and with a heavy heart.
I had been so confused and embarrassed that all coherent thoughts had vanished from my head, but now something hit me with blinding clarity.
There is one favour I might ask, Your Highness.
I stammered out the words.
My brother, he has recently come to London with me and is a great admirer of you. If you could find him a place in your household...
I hadn't finished the sentence, but he grinned.
Then you would have to come and visit him frequently, wouldn't you, Bright Eyes? Sisterly duty, don't you know?
When I said nothing, he nodded.
What is this young man's name?
It's Ronnie, sir. Ronald Barton.
And is Mr. Barton also a cook?
No, sir, but he has held several positions in a great house in Yorkshire and knows the protocol. He would welcome the chance to be a footman, I am sure.
He stroked my cheek again.
Have him come to see my butler. I'm sure we can find a place for him, if his sister promises to visit him.
You are very kind, sir,
I muttered, not promising anything.
He will be so grateful, I assure you.
I suppose I'd better let you get back to your kitchen, and I also have an appointment for which I am running late.
He backed away from me.
However, I look forward to seeing you again before too long, when we both have a little more time.
The way he looked at me made me feel so uncomfortable that I blushed again, making him laugh. He patted my cheek and walked past me, down the stairs, across the foyer, and out through the great front doors. I fled through the pass door, back to the safety of my part of the palace.
Chapter 9. The moment that great door swung shut behind me, I stood alone in the empty hallway, trying hard to compose myself. It had never occurred to me before that I might be in any way desirable to a man. No man had ever looked at me in that way before. Actually, I had had little contact with men before coming to the palace. It was almost all female staff at the Tillys' household, apart from a groom, a coachman and a couple of gardeners, who were all elderly. It was true that Nelson seemed interested in me, but he was a harmless sort of chap, and I took his interest more as friendship than anything of a sexual nature. I had heard of the Prince of Wales's reputation, of course. He was mentioned in newspapers as having been spotted with this woman at a race meeting or dining with yet another woman. It was said he always had a mistress, and now it seemed he had set his sights on me. Don't be ridiculous, I told myself. The prince wasn't really interested in me. He was enjoying making a young servant uncomfortable. But one had heard whispers of masters who had designs on their servant girls, who used their power to have their way. And it was the girl who suffered the consequences, while the man walked away whistling. But how did one say no to a prince? There was an obvious answer. Make sure I avoided him. That was when I remembered something else. I had fulfilled my obligation to Ronnie Barton. I was free of him. He could take up a position with the prince, and it was up to him what he made of it. However, I certainly didn't plan to visit him at the prince's palace. I was sure that by then the prince would have forgotten about me anyway. I tucked my hair hastily back into my cap and hurried back to the kitchen. Eyes turned to watch me as I entered.
Well? Mr. Angelo demanded. Spill the beans? Did you put too much bicarb in the scones? Are you getting the boot?
No, cook.
The Queen complimented me. She thought the scones were delicious, and she has instructed me to make them for her every afternoon.
Well, that's a turn-up, isn't it? Mr. Angelo raised an eyebrow. Mr. Rowland isn't going to be happy with that news when he returns.
I'm sorry, Cook, I said. I really am. I did nothing to push myself forward, I promise you.
You can't help being a good cook. Make the most of it.
As I started back to my station, he took my arm.
Are you all right? You look white as a sheet, girl. I imagine being summoned to Her Majesty for the first time was quite terrifying for you, but you came through with flying colours.
It wasn't that, Cook, I said. She was kind to me. It was just that... I broke off, now not willing to talk about it.
Come on, spill the beans. What did you do? Break a precious ornament? Trip over the carpet?
No. The Prince of Wales was there and he... Again, I couldn't go on.
He got a little too friendly, did he? Not the first time he couldn't keep his hands off the servants. But don't worry, he's not that fond of his mama, so he won't be turning up too often. And when he does, you make sure you stay in the kitchen.
He gave me a brisk nod.
Now get back to work or there will be no pudding for the Queen's dinner and you'll be out of favour again.
I was still blushing bright red as I headed back to my table. Nelson looked up from the potatoes he was peeling and gave me a wink.
Going up in the world, aren't we? He said.
It wasn't funny. It was terrifying, I replied.
So what's it like?
Out on their side of the palace. Very fancy.
The staircase and the hallways were very fancy indeed, I replied.
Lots of paintings and statues and vases. But the sitting room was quite ordinary, just like you'd see in any large house.
And the Queen? What was she like? I've never actually seen her in person, apart from through the window.
Small and round. She didn't look at all queenly, and she was very kind to me.
Well, you made her food that she liked. They say the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, but the same applies to the Queen.
Eating is her one comfort, so we've heard.
Enough of that gossip, young Nelson, or those spuds will never be boiled in time, Mrs. Sims said, looking up from the steak she was trimming.
As I went past her to my own table, she murmured,
You might want to watch yourself, dearie. There are those here who take offence easily.
Because I was summoned to the Queen?
Because you're below them in the pecking order, and you've suddenly found favour.
I'm really sorry, I didn't mean to offend anyone.
Of course you didn't. But a closed environment like this isn't healthy. It breeds jealousy and suspicion. For my part, I say congratulations and good luck to you, but there are others who might not be above sprinkling a little salt into your puddings. So be on your guard.
Thank you, I will. I went back to work, separating egg yolks into a basin. As I worked, I glanced around the kitchen. Which of them might want to get back at me?
Mr. Francis, the second in command, clearly disliked me and made it clear that no woman should be anywhere near him. The other woman, Mrs. Gillespie, was not exactly friendly. There were the four yeoman cooks who regarded me as a necessary nuisance, and the three apprentices, who were easy to get along with.
In truth, I hardly knew them.
We chatted at meals and they seemed friendly enough. The only other girl was Ruby, a scullery maid and therefore beneath me. I was sure that Mr. Rowland could easily carry a grudge and I'd have to think carefully about how to break this news to him. He returned that evening, just as we were assembling the trolleys to be wheeled up for the Queen's dinner.
So sorry to have left you in the lurch, he said to me. But am I glad that I went to the hospital? They told me my cut could have become infected and festered, and I could have died from blood poisoning.
And he held up a heavily bandaged hand.
So I'm afraid it's all up to you tonight. I hope you haven't attempted any puddings beyond your scope.
Oh, no, Cook. Mr. Angelo instructed me to just stick to a simple Bavarian cream, as the Queen is only dining with Princess Louise.
C'est bien. Very good. I hope that the tea service went smoothly.
It did, Cook. In fact, the Queen let it be known that she found the scones tasty.
Did I make the scones before I left? I can't remember, but I do not think so.
No, Cook. I made them. They were one of the few things I learned to do well from my old cook. She had a particularly good recipe.
So you saved the day. I'm in your debt.
And since the Queen seemed to enjoy my scones, I wondered if this might be a task I could undertake every day, if you were agreeable, cook.
He frowned for a moment, then nodded.
Why not? It would let me be free to make the more complicated cakes that she so loves.
So that was that. I had done it. As soon as I completed the pudding, I rushed up to my room and wrote a letter to Ronnie Barton. Today I met with the Prince of Wales. He is willing to find you a position in his service. You are to report to his butler and mention that you are my brother, and the prince is willing to give you a chance. I have thus fulfilled my obligation to you and do not wish to hear from you again. Then I slipped out after our supper and deposited the letter in the nearest postbox. I did not receive an answer, but I had done what he had requested, and he could have no more reason to bother me. That Sunday, I went out walking with Nelson. It was a bitterly cold and miserable day. The wind threatened to tear my bonnet from my head. Nelson offered me his arm and I was glad to take it as we were swept along the street. Nelson suggested that this was no day for a walk in the park. I agreed. We walked down to Victoria Station, then took the underground to South Kensington and paid a visit to the Natural History Museum. What an imposing building that was, more like a palace than Buckingham. We spent a pleasant afternoon examining the exhibits, the dioramas of wildlife from around the world, the dinosaur skeletons and the collection of rocks and minerals. These latter I found the most fascinating. I suppose every woman is naturally drawn to precious stones. As we walked, we chatted amiably, although, as always, I was on my guard not to say the wrong thing. I almost did when I suggested that we visit a certain gallery, and Nelson was surprised.
"You've been here before?" he asked.
I was about to say that my father took us all to the museums when we were children, but stopped myself at the last minute.
"No, I saw the arrow on the wall, directing us this way," I said quickly.
After that, the pleasant atmosphere of the afternoon seemed to have vanished, at least for me. Nelson still acted as if nothing had changed.
"How about that?"
he said as we stood before the exhibit of the African plains and saw a giraffe.
"I wonder how long it takes to swallow if your neck is that size."
When I didn't answer right away, he said,
"Is everything all right, Helen? I hope you don't find my presence too boring or offensive."
"On the contrary," I replied, "I'm sorry if I'm a poor specimen of a companion today. It has been a worrying week." And I told him about my encounter with the Prince of Wales. Then he was most solicitous.
"I've heard about him.
I thought you looked quite unsettled when you came back into the kitchen, but assumed it was the shock of meeting the Queen.
I'm just praying that he is the sort who likes to make servant girls uncomfortable and flirts with every female," I said. "I don't know what I'd do if he did request that I be sent over to his household, or if I found myself alone with him."
"Give him a good kick where he'd remember it," Nelson said, then realised this might be too offensive a remark to a young lady.
"I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that,"
he broke off in embarrassment. I laughed.
"On the contrary, it was the perfect suggestion,"
and he joined me in laughter.
"You're such a splendid girl, Helen," he said. "I know I've no right to ask, and of course I'm only an undercook like yourself and not in any position to think of the future, but is there a chance you'd consider me as someone who'd like to court you properly?"
Oh dear, I did like him. I did enjoy his company, but he was a mate, a pal, nothing more.
"Nelson, I was told in no uncertain terms that stepping out with a fellow was frowned upon," I said. "I don't want to lose my job."
I saw his face fall.
"I really do like you," I said. "I'm having a grand time this afternoon with you, and I'd certainly like to repeat an outing with you. But let's take things one step at a time, shall we?
As you say, neither of us is in any position to make any plans for the future beyond what we have to cook for tomorrow's meals." He grinned.
"You're right about that."
"The only thing I can promise you is that there's no one else in my life."
"That's good then." He gave a satisfied little nod. Shall we go and see if they've a tea room here? I could do with a hot cuppa and a bun, couldn't you? I agreed. Over tea, he told me about his family. His mother, the matriarch, and his six brothers and sisters. His father had met with an accident while working on the railways when Nelson was 12, and he had gone into service right away to support his family. Boot boy to start with, he said, and worked my way up to undercook. Found I liked the cooking part. Just like me, I said. I started off as a housemaid, up at 5 to get the boiler going and light the fires. We've got such a lot in common, it's no wonder we get along so well, he said. And I realised that, yes, we did have so much in common. Was I wrong to have ideas above my current station about the man I'd like to marry someday? And I remembered the promise I had made at my interview, that I would not have any suitors. That would be a convenient excuse if Nelson began to take our friendship too seriously. Chapter 10. I heard no more from Ronnie Barton, so I had to presume he had applied for the position with the Prince of Wales and been granted it. After that, I found that I could finally breathe more easily. I did everything required of me. I made my daily scones, and in the evenings I studied those recipe books, wondering if I would ever be able to produce a soufflé or Mazarin to the Queen's satisfaction. Christmas was approaching, and we were informed that the Queen would be departing for Osborne House on the Isle of Wight, where, as was her custom, she would join other members of her family for the holiday. She would be taking with her Mr. Angelo and several senior members of the kitchen staff, all men. It was explained to me that they did not like to include women in the party because of the travel arrangements. It was not seemly to stuff one woman into a third-class carriage with 7 men, or to have to use the same facilities when nature called. It was also imparted to me that we who were left behind would be cooking for the palace household members, a simpler sort of menu altogether, and would be allowed to join our families for Christmas Day if we wished, since there would be enough cooks with no family ties to put together a Christmas dinner. Did I want to join Louisa and her new family? I wasn't at all sure, but I thought it might be churlish of me not to do so. She had returned from her honeymoon, and I made the journey to Highgate on my next day off. She looked different, somehow, immediately more poised and grown up. Her hair was perfectly piled upon her head, and she was wearing a dark green high-necked dress. She held out her hands to me as I was ushered in.
Bella, how lovely to see you. You don't know how often I thought of you while we were away. Do come and sit by the fire, and we'll take some tea.
She turned to the hovering maid. Please tell cook that my sister and I will take tea now and not wait for your mistress.
Very good, Mrs. Harrison, she said, and retreated.
I studied her with interest. Did 1 month of marriage turn a girl into a confident grown-up woman? As soon as the door was shut, Louisa looked at me and gave a very girlish, impish grin.
It's rather fun, isn't it? I do like having people to wait on me. It's been for so long that I've had to do everything myself. I even have my mother-in-law's maid to do my hair.
It looks very impressive, I said.
So how was your honeymoon?
The hotel was most agreeable, she said. It had a glassed-in conservatory that faced the promenade, so on inclement days we would sit, and Billy would read the newspapers, and I'd read the women's magazines, and we'd take tea. I was still studying her face. Was she trying hard to put on an act, or had she really turned into a remote stranger?
That wasn't what I meant, I said. How was your honeymoon?
She glanced around, then leaned closer to me.
It was rather awful to start with, she said in a whisper. I mean, I had no idea what to expect. Do you know exactly what it entails? It's shocking, Bella, what men like to do to our bodies. Why were we never told?
Our mother died.
But could you see her informing us of such things? She was always so refined. I bet she wouldn't have said a word either, Louisa said. But I have to say that Billy was very patient with me, and now I've quite learned to endure it.
Endure it? Are you not supposed to feel more positive than that? She gave a little shrug. I have to confess that I don't enjoy it in the way that Billy seems to. I mean, all that bouncing up and down and panting. But I suppose it is a necessary obligation for a married woman, if one wants children, and I may come to enjoy it more as time passes. Although, frankly, between ourselves, I think it's rather silly and annoying when I'm tired at the end of the day and I'd rather be asleep. She broke off as the door opened and the maid came in pushing a tea trolley. We allowed her to pour cups for us. The little cakes, I noted with satisfaction, were not up to our standards at the palace. "About Christmas," I said, "I have good news. I'm to have Christmas Day free if I wish." Her face fell. "Oh dear, Bella, I'm so sorry, but we're to go to the family farm for Christmas, to Billy's grandfather, out in the country, and we'll be gone for a whole week. Do you think your employer would give you a week off to come with us?" "I'm afraid not," I said. "Just Christmas Day." "I'm so sorry," she said again. "It won't seem like Christmas without you." "That's all right," I said. "I'm sure I'll have a jolly time with my fellow servants." She reached out and took my hand, squeezing it. "Bella, I can't bear to think of you as a servant while I enjoy all of this. It's not right. It's not fair. Won't you change your mind and come to live with us?" "You are very sweet, Louisa, but I have no wish to be the spinster sister with your mother-in-law making it her mission to find me a suitable husband." I smiled at her. "I really like my place of employment, and I'm doing very well. I've been promoted to assistant pastry chef." "Oh, so it must be a very large kitchen, if there is a chef just for pastry, and an assistant too. We only have one cook and one scullery maid here." "It is very large." "Ah, so it must be a hotel or restaurant." Her face lit up. "I was worried before that it was something not quite proper." "Very proper, I assure you. I'm just not allowed to tell you. Company rules." "I see." She looked happier now. "I'm glad you are in a good position, although I wish you did not have to earn a living." "But I enjoy it," I said. "I'm becoming quite skilled." "And you will meet someone soon, I'm sure," she said. "Someone who will make you as happy as Billy is making me." "I hope so." We sat there, our hands still clasped together. Christmas approached. The Queen and her retinue departed. We stood lined up in the foyer to give her a proper send-off. She hobbled past on the arm of her Indian munshi, using her stick to walk with, but nodding to us. When she spotted me, I saw recognition in her eyes and she gave me a little smile. Then she was helped into the carriage, more like lifted and bundled, actually, and off they went. Mr. Angelo wished all of us a Merry Christmas and said that the wine steward had been instructed to open a bottle of claret and a bottle of port for our celebrations. He departed too, along with other senior cooks, leaving Mr. Francis in charge and the two ladies and we juniors to hold the fort. It was a pleasant few days. Meals consisted of big soups and stews, followed by suet puddings that were easily made and easily cleared up. On Christmas Eve it snowed, and we went out into the grounds for a snowball fight. Even Mrs. Sims joined in, shrieking when a snowball hit her, although Mrs. Gillespie clearly disapproved. She was a strange woman, polite enough, but quite reserved and never really friendly. That evening, one of the apprentices brought in a Christmas tree, and we decorated it with candles, glass balls, and paper chains. Then we sat around the tree singing carols. I was just making my way up to bed when I heard someone calling. "Helen!" I turned to see Nelson behind me in the hallway. "I just wanted to say Happy Christmas," he said. "I'll be taking off early tomorrow to go home for the day and spend it with my old mum and the family. But I didn't want to go without giving you this. I didn't want to give it to you in front of the others," he said. "They might get ideas." And he handed me a little box. "It's not much," he said, "but I wanted to give you a token." I opened it, praying that it wasn't jewellery, especially not a ring. Inside was a lavender sachet, prettily embroidered with flowers. "I had my sister make it for you," he said. "She does embroidery for a seamstress." It's beautiful. I felt embarrassed because I hadn't bought anything for him. He must have realised this. No, don't say it. He held up his hand. It's the dumb thing that a young man should shower his special girl with gifts. Never the other way around.
It is very sweet of you, Nelson, and I really appreciate it, I said.
We stood alone in that hallway, rather close to each other.
I should take this up to my room and put it away safely. Before you go, he said, and put a hand on my arm to restrain me. You should look up.
I did, wondering what he was talking about. We were standing in the Spartan hallway, which had no adornment of any kind.
Well, what a surprise, he said. Mistletoe.
I wonder who put that up there. A sprig of mistletoe was hanging from the overhead electric light. Before I knew it, he had taken me into his arms and was kissing me. I didn't struggle or try to push him away. I let him kiss me. When we broke apart, he was beaming at me.
Best Christmas ever, he said. I'll remember this for a long time.
I went on up to bed, trying to come to terms with what had just happened. Should I have stopped him? Had I now given him too much encouragement? For a first kiss, it had been gentle, not at all alarming, but wasn't I supposed to have felt something? In truth, all I was aware of was his slightly cold lips pressing against mine. Not unpleasant, but certainly not the divine sensation written about in romance novels. I lay in bed, listening to the wind rattling the window panes, trying to come to terms with what had happened. I had known he was keen on me, but this had taken it one step beyond friendship. The trouble was that I wanted more. I wanted to fall in love, to feel my heart skip a beat every time he looked at me, to live happily ever after. And I couldn't picture a life ahead with Nelson and his old mum and noisy siblings in the house behind the gasworks. In spite of everything that had happened to me, I suppose I hadn't learned to discard my aristocratic roots. Maybe I'd have to someday. I fell asleep eventually and awoke to the distant sound of church bells. Christmas Day, I murmured, and thought of Christmas days in the past when Mama was still alive. A stocking beside my bed with an orange, a chocolate mousse, maybe a book, and a new pair of gloves. Never anything extravagant, but exciting just the same. For the past few years, Christmas Day had meant up at dawn to light fires, and later a rush to get the stuffing made and the turkey into the oven. At least there wouldn't be too much work for us today. And at least I had a present to unwrap as well as one already given. I had bought a diary with a lock and key for Louisa and sent it off in good time before she departed for the country. A parcel had arrived from her, but I waited until Christmas morning to open it. First, we had to attend church service in the palace chapel, but then we came back to a big breakfast with sausages, eggs, and bacon. The birds were stuffed and went into the ovens. After that, we gathered around the tree. Everyone received a little gift from Her Majesty. It was a royal medal with her likeness on it, and also a gift from Mr. Angelo. This one was more practical and was a new handkerchief for each of us. Finally, I opened Louise's gift. It was a pretty necklace of amethyst beads, a warm scarf, and a golden guinea. I felt tears coming to my eyes. It had been years since anyone had brought me anything nice or special. I found myself feeling guilty. I had judged her so harshly for wanting to marry when I had funded her education, and for not seeming to appreciate my sacrifice. Now I saw that she did care for me. The Christmas feast started at 1 o'clock. We joined the other members of the household staff in the servants' dining hall. The tables were laid with white cloths and decorated with holly and ivy. There were crackers beside each plate. 2 turkeys and 4 geese were carried in, their skins nicely browned and glistening. Mr. Francis and Arthur carved for us while tureens of roast potatoes, chestnut stuffing, sage and onion stuffing, bread sauce, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower with a white sauce, cabbage and gravy were passed around. Claret was poured. We pulled our crackers, put on paper hats, read the silly mottos and riddles, and demonstrated our toys and puzzles. Then we said grace and ate until we couldn't stuff in another bite. There was a blast on a bugle, and the Christmas puddings were carried in, flaming with brandy and with a sprig of holly stuck in them. I had helped to make these on Stir Up Sunday back in November, and most of them had been sent with the cooks to Osborne House. But there were plenty for us, served with the custard and brandy butter I had prepared. There were even several silver threepenny pieces inside, and I was lucky enough to get one of them. "Make a wish," the parlour maid sitting opposite me instructed. I wasn't quite sure what to wish for. "Let the new year be favourable for me," I whispered to myself. "No unpleasant surprises, please." After that mammoth meal, you might not have thought that anyone would want to eat again for weeks. However, we served tea a little later than usual. Mr. Rowland had insisted on making the Christmas cakes for this tea. Ours was indeed a work of art. It had sat on the shelf resplendent in royal icing and waiting for the china figures to complete the snow scene. Now it was decorated with sledding figures, snowmen and children throwing snowballs. After tea, we sat around the fire, too full of food to do much. We played some party games, the minister's cat and charades. Later, for supper, we put out plates of cold turkey and goose, pickles and bread, but I couldn't face any. Nelson had said that it was his best Christmas ever. All I could think was that it was the nicest Christmas I had spent in years. Chapter 11. The new year dawned, a year that promised the great excitement of the Diamond Jubilee, 60 years on the throne for our Queen. But it didn't start with great jubilation. The Queen returned from Osborne House, suffering from a horrible cold and in a foul mood. We were instructed to make all kinds of medicinal broths as well as the standard calf's foot jelly. Her Majesty sent most of them back, declaring them to be disgusting and useless. There was no entertaining, and we undercooks spent our time practicing new and complicated dishes from the library of cookery books, only to have to send them to the ladies and gentlemen of the household, or eat them ourselves. It was murmured around the palace that the Queen's health was deteriorating and she might not even survive to celebrate in the summer. "Don't you believe it," Nelson whispered to me. "She's a tough old bird and stubborn too. She'll hang on just to make sure she rides in that coach down the mall." To my relief, Nelson and I had settled back into our comfortable relationship. It had snowed heavily just after Christmas, and walking outside was treacherous, so we had not ventured out much. I had heard from Louisa that her Christmas in the country had been excessively dull, and that Billy's grandfather drank far too much, but I hadn't had a chance to visit her in person to hear the details. However, I was secretly glad I had not been able to attend. Cooped up in the snow with Billy's relatives would have indeed been a penance. I did not have a chance to visit Louisa until the end of January. I went to the big house in Highgate on my afternoon off and thought that there was something strange about Louisa, something different. Then it dawned on me. "Are you pregnant?" I asked. She shook her head. "Not that I know of." "No, there is something else that I have to tell you. Something I'm not quite sure about." She paused, twisting the long strand of jet beads she wore around her neck. Then she blurted out, "Billy wants us to move to Australia." I certainly hadn't expected that news. "Australia? Isn't that where they send convicts? Whatever for?" "These days it's a prosperous part of the empire," she said. "Lots of good land, and they are dying for people to go and settle it. Billy's father has told him he'll set him up with all he needs to start a sheep or cattle farm. He can get thousands of acres, and we can export the sheep and the wool to England. We have a chance to be really rich, Bella. We'll be somebody's. And in Australia, they don't care if your father was a butcher or a chimney sweep." I was lost for words. "Say something," she said at last. "I'm very happy for you, if that's what you want, Louisa," I muttered at last. "That's just the problem. I'm not at all sure it's what I want, Bella. I mean,
I want Billy to have the chance to get on and make something of his life, but Australia is so far away. I was wondering, she paused and looked up at me, if you'd come with us. You're all I've got, Bella. And when it comes to childbirth and things, well, I'd be scared to be all on my own. And she reached out and took my hand. You will come, won't you? Billy will take care of everything. Thoughts whirled around inside my head. I didn't want to abandon my only sister, but what would there be for me on a farm thousands of miles away from home? The chance to marry a farmer and be stuck in the middle of nowhere? And what of my cooking ambitions? The chance to lead my own life? It struck me that, for the first time, I had to put myself first. I shook my head. I'm sorry, Louisa, but I can't. I have dreams of my own. I want to become a good cook, a proper chef. I want to make my own way in life, not be a hanger-on, the poor unmarried sister in your life. I've heard there are plenty of unmarried men in Australia, she said. Farmers and cowhands, and uncouth, uneducated men. I want more for myself, Louisa. And you think being a cook will get you the respect and status you desire? She said sharply. A cook is also a servant. Then I saw tears well up in her eyes. I'm sorry. That was stupid of me. It's just that I don't want to move so far from you. I shook my head. I'm sorry too. I don't want you to move so far away, but I have found a place where I feel that I belong, Louisa. I love my work. I'm learning more every day. You should see the cakes I can make now. I gave her an encouraging smile, but she turned away, still upset. It crossed my mind that she was a little like my father, who also skulked when he couldn't get his own way. But in this case, it was not over a trifle. A move to Australia would be overwhelming for anyone. Maybe when you are settled and you can tell me what conditions are like and how far you are from towns, I'll consider it. I may even come for a visit, I said. But not now. Not when I'm just beginning to find a place for myself in the world. Very well, she said stiffly. Then you had better hug your little sister one last time, because we may never see each other again. Are you leaving so soon? I asked, horrified. No, not until the summer at the earliest, she said. Billy's father has a land agent working to find the best farmland, and we have to secure a passage. So of course I'll be seeing you again, you silly goose, I said. Do you think I'm not going to visit you between now and the summer? She gave a sad little laugh. Of course you are. It's just that once we say goodbye, it will really mean goodbye. She took my hands and squeezed them tightly. Do think it over, Bella. My mind would be so much more at ease if I knew you were going to be with me in that far-off land. I will think it over, Louisa, I said, although my mind was already made up. I felt guilty when I saw the hope in her eyes. It could be a wonderful adventure, you know. They have kangaroos and koala bears and all sorts of funny things. Louisa, I can't marry a kangaroo, I said, making her laugh and easing the tension. I spent a miserable few days feeling alternately guilty and angry that she had put me in such an untenable position. Of course I didn't want to go to Australia and live on a farm, but I saw the fear in Louisa's eyes, and she was so very young. Then I reminded myself that I had put my family first since my mother died. I had endured years of humiliation and servitude for Louisa. Now I wanted to become an expert cook. But more than that, I wanted to be an independent woman with the means to live life on my own terms. Now it was time for me. I threw myself with enthusiasm into improving my cooking skills, even creating what might become signature dishes while we waited for daily bulletins on the Queen's health and her recovery from her current illness. Then one day at the beginning of February, when the snow had turned to slush, making walking outside even more unpleasant, Mr. Angelo summoned us all together. He had an announcement from Her Majesty. The Queen felt that she was not going to get better as long as she stayed in London. She was anxious to go to the Riviera immediately. A
Apparently, she had spent her winters on the Mediterranean coast several times before. In the past, she had stayed at hotels or villas belonging to other high-born people and only taken her personal maids and attendants. However, this time, a brand new hotel had been built specifically for her.
"It's called the Excelsior Regina, if you can believe it," Mr. Angelo said with a grin. "A whopping great place with a whole wing for the Queen and her retinue. So this time she plans to take a good portion of her household."
"Does that include kitchen staff, cook?"
Jimmy, one of the apprentices, asked.
"It does, although I can't see us taking you, boy. You'd get into too much trouble in the hot climes of the Riviera with those French girls." And he grinned again.
"Don't they have chefs at hotels?" Mr. Phelps asked.
"They do, but the Queen prefers her meals prepared the way she likes them, cooked by people she knows, and she's suspicious of foreign cooking, as you well know."
"So who will you be taking?" Jimmy persisted.
"Not me, I firmly hope," Mr. Francis said quickly. "I am near retirement and too old for such a strenuous journey. Besides, I can't take the heat any longer."
"It's only Nice, Mr. Francis, not the Congo," Mr. Angelo replied, "but I will respect your wishes. It will only be a small contingent. We will mainly be cooking for an intimate party of her relatives. Should she decide to hold a bigger banquet, the hotel chefs are at our disposal. So, who would like to go? I should like to take your wishes into account." He looked around the kitchen.
"I don't think you'd want to take us ladies," Mrs. Gillespie said. "It wouldn't be right for us to travel with the men or go out unescorted in foreign parts."
"Quite right, Mrs. Gillespie," Mrs. Sims said vehemently. "The tales one hears is about those Frenchmen and Italians. No sense of decorum at all. They pinch bottoms."
"I am a Frenchman and I resent that," Mr. Rowland said. "I am as well behaved as any Englishman. Better than most."
"I'm not saying all Frenchmen, Mr. Rowland," Mrs. Sims said hastily. "Anyone can see that you are a proper gentleman."
"Of course we'll be taking Mr. Rowland," Mr. Angelo said. "How would Her Majesty survive without her cakes and puddings?" He gave a nod to Mr. Rowland.
"Added to which, we'll need someone to interpret for us and to communicate with our French kitchen workers." He looked around at us.
"I think we should take two cooks, Mr. Phelps and Mr. Williams, as the senior men, if neither of you has strong objections."
"Not at all, cook," Mr. Phelps replied. "I think the air on the Riviera would be most agreeable for my rheumatics."
"And I, too, don't mind getting away from the winter rain," Mr. Williams added.
"That's that, then," Mr. Angelo said. "Plus one of you young upstarts to do the basic prep. Nelson, you seem to be the most advanced in your skills."
I glanced across at Nelson, who had turned bright red.
"If you please, cook, I'd prefer not to go so far from my mother, who is not in the best of health and relies on me, not having my dad around, you see."
Mr. Angelo sighed.
"Very good, Nelson, I respect that sentiment. So I suppose it better be Jimmy instead as the senior apprentice. In spite of my misgivings about temptations with French women," there was a general chuckle from the assembled group.
"Unless he has family obligations he can't bear to tear himself away from."
There was a big grin on Jimmy's face.
"Oh no, cook, I've been dying to travel and see the world. Sign me up, I'm your man."
"Well, that's settled then. Myself, Mr. Rowland, Mr. Phelps, Mr. Williams, and Jimmy it shall be. Those of you who are left will be catering for the members of the household who do not travel with Her Majesty."
"And a nice pleasant time we'll be having of it too," Mrs. Sims muttered to me as we went back to our stations. As I went to join Mr. Rowland in our part of the kitchen, he seemed quite put out, and I had to remind him that he had already added 2 teaspoons full of baking powder to the sponge.
"Thank you, my dear," he said, which in itself was strange.
He wasn't known for his gratitude and usually took full credit for anything I had baked. He had certainly never called me my dear before.
"Is something wrong, Mr. Rowland? Or are you just excited that you will be visiting your native land again?"
He looked around, then leaned closer to me.
"Au contraire, Helen. I am not looking forward to it one bit." I dread the sea crossing. I suffer badly from mal de mer.
Surely the sea crossing is quite short. It is only an hour at sea from Dover to the French coast, so I've been told.
Not the way she travels.
Again he glanced around to see if anyone was close enough to hear.
She takes the train from Portsmouth, then the royal yacht to Cherbourg. That's an overnight of being tossed around. I know, I did it once, never again. And to be frank with you, I do not have any great love for my countrymen from the south. Those people in Nice, they are more Italian than French. Scoundrels and brigands, the lot of them.
But think of the lovely sunshine and the fruit and the flowers.
Like all young girls, you are a romantic. Me, I think of the bad drains and the typhoid.
I laughed. I can see you are not at all romantic, Mr. Rowland, I said.
I have learned that life is hard and dreary, Helen. We are born, we work, we create things of beauty that are devoured in a few seconds. And then we grow old and die.
I was still smiling, and in a way flattered. It was the first time he was talking to me as if I was a person and not an underling. I hope there is more to life than that, I said. I must admit my own experience until now has not been wonderful, but I am hopeful about the future.
You will no doubt find a young man, fall in love, marry and leave me, just when I have found an assistant who is not impossible to work with and who actually seems to have some talent.
Thank you, monsieur. I am honored that you think so, I said in French. But I have no intentions of falling in love until I have learned to be a good pastry chef. He frowned.
How is it that you know my language? Have you ever been to my country?
No, monsieur, I replied. I was educated as a young girl. I came from a good family and my father spoke excellent French, but he and my mother both died and I had to go into service.
So you see, life is hard, he agreed. But now I remember, when I cut my finger and I uttered a few choice words in French, you understood, did you not? You told me to calm myself.
I nodded. I didn't know the exact meaning of some of those words, but I understood the sentiments you were expressing.
Now that I know you speak my language, I shall enjoy having a chance to converse occasionally. I find that I'm losing the facility, having not spoken it for so long.
You have been in this country for a long time, I asked.
I came as a child, he said. My father was a pastry chef before me in Paris, and then he was invited to London to work at a Gunter's as a confectioner. I learned my profession from the best.
You certainly did, I replied.
Your petits fours are exquisite. I hope to learn many things from you when you have time to show me.
How long do you think Her Majesty will be away?
She usually stays for at least 2 months. 2 months of bad water and hay fever from all those blossoms.
And he sighed. I went away rather stunned. I had seen Mr. Rowland as a difficult individual who saw me as a necessary nuisance. Now it seemed as if I might have a chance of a real relationship in the future, even a modicum of friendship. After this, the kitchen was in a hustle and bustle of preparation for the grand voyage. Mr. Angelo agonized over which of the cookery books should be taken with him, as well as his particular favorite pots and pans.
I must have all my recipes, that is obvious. And I know they tell us they have a well-stocked kitchen, he said. But will they have a mould just right for Her Majesty's favourite blancmange? Or a turban for that game tureen? And my fish poacher? Do they know how to poach fish in France? And how do I know what kinds of fish will be available in the local markets?
The pile of equipment he could not do without rose higher and higher. I wondered how they'd manage to carry it. There was a discussion about what they were going to wear. It was no doubt warmer in southern climes. The men complained they only had dark suits for their days off. How could they acquire linen suits? Mrs. Sims and I watched it all with amusement.
like a pack of women they are, wondering what to wear and whether they'll look fashionable in France, she muttered. But I'm glad that we're not going. I wish they'd be gone and we could get back to peace and quiet and our proper routine again.
As it happened, they found out they were to leave sooner than they expected. Her Majesty, or rather one of her secretaries, decided that it would be a good idea if her cooks went ahead so that the kitchen was up and working by the time she arrived. So there was added panic that they had to leave in 2 days. The good news was that they were to take the usual boat train to Dover, and then cross the channel to Boulogne by the shortest route. This would remove the long sea crossing, but instead it would be an extended and uncomfortable journey to the south of France by train if you were sitting up all night in the third-class carriage. I felt they were rather ungrateful to complain. They'd be going abroad, seeing the world, actually travelling through Paris. I lay in bed that night, picturing what it would be like to travel. My father had been to the continent as a young man before being commissioned into the Indian Army. He had seen much of the world. Maybe someday. I came downstairs the next morning to find the kitchen in a state of panic. "What on earth is happening?" I asked Nelson, who was busy stirring the porridge for the servants' breakfast.
"It's Mr. Rowland," he whispered. "He's had an accident. He was going to the, you know, in the middle of the night, and he tripped over the suitcase he had open on his floor. He's fallen and twisted his ankle so badly he can't walk on it. He may have broken it."
"Oh, poor Mr. Rowland," I said. "If he can't walk, how can he possibly travel to France?"
"That's just the problem," Nelson said. "He can't. Cook is in a right state."
Even as Nelson uttered these words, Mr. Angelo stormed into the kitchen.
"Of all the stupid things to have done," he blustered. "Can't walk, can't travel. What are we going to do now? That's what I'd like to know. We don't have a pastry chef. None of us knows a word of French beyond the names of dishes we have to cook. That's not going to cut the mustard, is it? How are we going to make our way across France, eh? And who is going to order for us at the market and talk to those foreign blokes at the hotel?"
"Excuse me, cook," Nelson said, "but Helen here speaks French."
There was an instant silence in the kitchen. Eyes turned to me. I felt my cheeks burning.
"You do?"
Mr. Angelo asked.
"You actually speak French more than La Plume de ma tante?"
I nodded, finding it hard to make myself speak.
"Yes, cook, I speak quite good French."
"Was one of your parents from that country?"
"No, cook, but my father was well-travelled and well-educated. I learned French at school and we sometimes spoke it at home."
"Well, blow me down with a feather," Mr. Angelo said. "Young woman, you are full of surprises. You seem to have a bit of talent when it comes to pastry and you speak French. I see no alternative. We'll have to take you with us."
"Me, cook?" I could hardly get out the words.
"Yes, you, go on then. You'd better go and pack your things."
I almost flew up the stairs with excitement. I was going to France. It was only when I reached my room that the truth hit me. If one went abroad, didn't one have to carry a passport? I didn't have one, and if one had to be procured for me, how could it possibly be in the name of Helen Barton? Surely I would need to produce a record of my birth before they'd give me a passport. I'd just have to come up with some reason why I couldn't travel. A sudden case of the grip. That's when it occurred to me that was just what Mr. Rowland had done. He had made it clear he hadn't wanted to go to France, and miraculously he'd hurt his ankle badly enough that he couldn't go. How convenient for him.
I went downstairs again and found Mr. Angelo wrapping blancmange molds in newspaper before putting them into a crate.
"This one is her favourite," he said, looking up at me.
"I doubt they'll have a mould in the shape of a rabbit, and she's like this one since she was a girl."
"Cook, I've just had a worrying thought," I said. "I presume one needs a passport to travel abroad. I don't have one."
"Neither do any of us ducks," he said.
"But we don't need it. We have a letter of passage to say that we are part of the Queen's retinue and they are to let us pass without hindrance. I'll have to have them add your name to it. But apart from that, Bob's your uncle.
Now get cracking. We don't have any time to waste.
Chapter 12.
I was going to France. And not just France, but the French Riviera. It seemed almost too good to be true. I half expected someone to tell me that a mistake had been made and a female servant was not allowed to travel after all. I retrieved my valise from under my bed and started to pack my pitiful wardrobe. Nothing I had was vaguely suitable for a fashionable resort or a warm climate. I had my uniform, one winter dress, one cotton shirtwaist, now a little tight, one summer skirt that had been let out from the days before I became a servant, my one good outfit from Louise's wedding, and a winter cloak. That was it. For a moment, I wondered if I could pay a rapid visit to Louisa and see if she had any extra clothing she could lend me. I had seen her trousseau, and it was quite generous. But I reminded myself she was shorter than I, and also I was too proud to ask for favours. But she had given me a golden guinea for Christmas, which was still tucked away in my purse, and I had my earnings since October in a savings account. Maybe when we reached France, I could find a dressmaker and have some suitable clothing made. I didn't think there would be an occasion for a blue velvet dress, but I packed it anyway. Now that I fully believed that miracles could happen, I wanted to be prepared for another one. I was told that we'd be leaving on the 11 o'clock boat train the next morning. The Queen and her party would follow 2 days later. I wrote to Louisa, telling her that I'd be going abroad so she wouldn't hear from me for a while, then faced the driving sleet to pop the letter into a postbox. I don't think I slept a wink that night. I was so excited. A little worried, too, if you want to know the truth. I had become passably competent at making cakes and pastries, but nothing like Chef Roland, and always under his supervision. I knew how fond the Queen was of her pastries. What if mine were not up to her standard? I reassured myself that there would be French chefs at the hotel, and I could ask them for advice. Also that Mr. Roland would presumably recover in a week or so and be sent out to join the party. When we assembled for breakfast in the morning, I could tell that the others in our party were as jittery as I was. "Not the day I choose to cross the channel, is it now?" Mr. Williams was muttering to Mr. Phelps. They broke off as I came to join them at the table, regarding me with glances that indicated I was an interloper and they did not welcome my presence. Rain beat against the high windows, and the wind howled through the chimney so that Mr. Angelo went to ask permission to use the carriage portal, where we could load in our baggage without getting soaked. We were just carrying out the many crates